Welcome, friends. You're listening to The Feeling is Music Hall, as presented by the Snohomish County Music Project. My name is Erica Lee, and today we are talking about social justice in music therapy with board-certified music therapist and returning friend of the podcast, V. Fansler. For those of you who have not yet met V, they are a board-certified music therapist working with children, youth, and families in transition. Additionally, with 5 years of clinical experience, they supervise music therapy staff and interns as senior music therapists at the Snohomish County Music Project. In the final stages of their master's in music therapy, their work centers trauma-informed care and the political nature of therapy, highlighting the ecological link between individual and communal well-being. Well, thank you for joining us again. If you missed last week's episode, we talked about what is music therapy. Basically, it is music and relationships and some boundaries.
Woo!
Wow.
Love it.
And we talked about all the ways that you music and you don't even know it.
That's right.
All right. So today we're talking about social justice in music therapy. What does that mean? What does it look like? How does a person's personal narrative shape their therapeutic experience? Or if you're the clinician, how does your narrative shape your philosophy on therapy? Oh. All right. So let's just jump right in, V. Mm-hmm. What does social justice in music therapy mean?
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. You ask me these questions.
So casually. Because all I have to do is ask you the question.
Oh, okay. So I guess sort of like we did with the what is music therapy, I want to back up into sort of maybe some underlying understandings.
Okay.
Okay. So the first of that is going to be that we bring all of who we are into therapy.
Tweet that.
We bring all of who we are into therapy. And regardless of the modality of the therapy or the ideas that our therapist has, each of our experiences and identities come with us. And if those aren't being acknowledged or celebrated in that space, they may be being extinguished or silenced or closeted. So,
wow.
Yeah. There we go.
That was so eloquent. That was so good.
And therapy is also a dynamic where the therapist has more power than
absolutely, yes,
the client, or whatever language you like to use when you're in the therapy space. Right.
Yes.
So, in addition to the power hierarchies that already exist, like race and gender and class and disability and body size and sexuality, and
list all of them.
All these things, ethnicity, oh my goodness. Okay. I'm sorry for whatever axis of oppression I left out just now, but you get the idea. So in addition to all of those, there's the added role definition and hierarchy of therapist and client.
Mm-hmm.
And marginalized identities tend to be overrepresented in clients or therapy participants.
Mm-hmm.
And privileged identities tend to be overrepresented in therapists. So that means that that power hierarchy is just even more layered on top of itself, so that there is a lot of potential for harm. And honestly, there is a lot of existing harm.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of ways that therapy has been explicitly activated as a tool for oppression, and that it is currently still activated as a tool for oppression, you know, explicitly, not yes. even accidental, unintended consequences.
Yes.
So if we're not thinking about social justice in therapy, we are likely
causing harm.
Right. Continuing. Yes. The harm that therapy can do.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm on board. Yeah. I so agree with you.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So that is that power dynamic in a therapeutic relationship.
Mm.
So how do then you as a clinician, and I'm talking about you specifically because you're really good at your own story.
Mm.
Everybody has their own story. Oh, so boy, we're not going to talk about other people's stories. how do you mitigate that power dynamic?
Right.
Or minimize it.
Right. So I think we can't undo the power hierarchies that exist just by sort of wishing them away or avoiding them or anything that, like, nothing about really the content that I do in a therapy session can, like, undo the fact that I'm white, you know?
Sure.
And so if I'm working with a person of color, that power dynamic exists, right? And so I guess one thing then is that to ignore it is, again, to erase those pieces of ourselves that we bring into it. And I want to be able to activate my full authentic self, especially when I'm a client in therapy.
Yeah.
Like, my therapist can have some boundaries or whatever, but I want them to be able to acknowledge their whole authentic self, right? And even the ways that that self changes in context, depending on who we're with and what we're doing.
Sure.
But I want to cultivate spaces as a therapist in which people are able to bring their whole selves with them, with the understanding that I already understand them as whole and that I'm coming with curiosity as to what exactly that is and how we can move to even more growing understandings of how our wholeness can sort of expand outward, rather than coming from kind of a fixing mindset of what is broken about a person and how can I, like, resolve that thing, right?
Because that's a very colonistic,
yes,
so, colonial way of thinking about somebody else.
Right, right. There's so many ways, and I guess I sort of touched on this, but, you know, for me as a queer person, like, if I the ways that therapy is actively used to harm people and to extinguish identities is ever present on my mind, partly because conversion therapy is such a strong example, where in that case, queer people enter into quote-unquote conversion therapy, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And the process is, it's a systematic, it's essentially like a cultural genocide project upon LGBTQ community,
mm-hmm,
where the process of the therapy is an overt effort to extinguish these marginalized aspects of ourselves. So
yeah,
there's, and I mean, that, like, that happens with so many marginalized identities in sometimes that explicit of ways,
and sometimes really
subtly,
under the cover,
right,
covert,
right,
ways, and ways, yeah, that are right under your nose,
right, and, yeah, ways in which, especially when, like I said, therapists are privilege identities are overrepresented in therapists,
mm-hmm,
and privilege makes us often unaware or able to not attend to the realities of how power shapes our relationships. That harm happens often in ways where the therapists themselves are not aware of the microaggressions that they're enduring. And I actually shouldn't even say they, I should say we, right?
Yeah,
because,
yeah,
I, as a therapist, also do these types of harm and microaggressions and have things that I'm not aware of in which, you know, my whiteness is sort of overtaking me.
Totally.
And despite whatever my intentions might be, I'm doing racism, right? I'm upholding, mm-hmm, racism in the space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that is so true. I even forgot what I was going to ask you next, because that just,
yeah,
it doesn't, like, blow my mind. Like, it's not a new concept that is what is happening. But I feel so heavily the weight of that.
Right.
And I had recently had some personal events happen where that is just on the forefront of my mind and, yeah, keeping me awake at night. And, yeah, so for any person going into any human services, particularly any therapy modality, it's another reason that it's so important that you are getting your cultural competencies. And that does not mean that it's only in racism. Or only, I can't even think
of
another
one. If you're like,
one.
I work with, I don't know.
I feel like racism, because of the Black Lives Matter movement and because LGBTQ rights are really hot topics right now, like, those two things immediately come to mind. But things that I feel like are a little bit more more covert, and their erasure is disability affirming work.
Yeah. And can I just actually come to that specifically? Because music therapy, I will say, is founded on ableism, to be pretty
clear.
Frank. Yeah. To be clear, music therapy is founded on ableism. So in the majority of cases, music therapists in the therapy space, if music therapists have diagnoses or identify as disabled, that is not a highlighted part of their identity in the therapy space. Mm. And contrastingly, clients in music therapy are almost always defined by some type of diagnosis or disability or illness. So the disability axis of oppression is almost always at play in music therapy sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Not always, but
largely.
Often. Yeah. Yeah.
And can I caveat that when we are doing an intake for a client, we do ask, like, what are you wanting therapy for? Mm-hmm. And so then we encourage, if the client or parent or whoever is talking to us, to give a diagnosis if they want to. But what you're saying is that the diagnosis is kind of used against the client rather than to be, because our programming specifically at the Music Project is for disability affirming. And so if you're autistic, we're embracing and affirming that identity. Whereas most music therapy programs and it's new like, students.
What's the problem? What's the goal area?
It's trying to assimilate somebody into a culture that's privileged and not affirming and embracing who they authentically are.
Right. And even outside of like work with, you know, autistic children is a huge branch of music therapy work. In hospitals, the clients are being defined by the state of their illness, right? Whereas the therapist is presented as sort of this healthy other who's there to like help or serve, which has power implications too. In institutions like, you know, behavioral health, there's diagnoses that come to define the space as well, where again, that is one piece of who someone is that we want to amplify and not erase, and where we also don't want to just define someone by that one aspect of
absolutely
who they are.
Yeah.
And even with music therapy being really foundationally based on ableist ideas of healthy, you know, sort of normative bodies and brains, right, being
successful,
being charged with quote unquote helping or serving or fixing, right, or erasing, if we're more direct, people with bodies that don't fit that sort of normative way, normative definition, bodies that are seen as, what do you call it? I can't think of the word, but bodies that are seen as abnormal, right? The idea being that the healthy other fixes the broken, you know, person.
Sure.
There's so much of a problem with that, right? And that is yet somehow so much of a foundation of our profession. And even that aside, just by the very nature of, again, overrepresentation of non-disabled people in therapist roles and disabled people in client roles, it is jarring how little, which is to say almost never, disability studies is part of music therapy education. So many music therapists enter into these spaces without a prior understanding of disability as an identity, simply thinking of disability as impairment, right? Where impairment is the idea of like, this is a thing that keeps me from doing things, and where disability as an identity is more socially grounded, more like, okay, yes, I'm in a wheelchair. That would not be disabling to me if there were actually ramps and space for me to navigate through my
world. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. The impairment has a connotation as something lacking. And I think for people that are able-bodied, the word limits has a very like negative, like stopping. Whereas at least in the community that I am part of for disabled people, it's more about like a safety. Like this is like the threshold where I am safe and then where I am not safe.
Right. And we're, as therapists, what we don't want to do is say, okay, this is this person's limit that they've, you know, expressed to me or that I've learned, right? And I'm going to spend my entire time with that person trying to push that limit, right? So, like, if I'm spending time with a person who has dementia and I know that, like, the thing that dementia does is make it difficult to remember things, I'm not – and it's a degenerative disease, like you're talking about.
Yeah.
I'm not really going to spend a lot of time – like sort of quizzing people about what they remember. I'm going to use that time to build up, to acknowledge, right, that part of the nature of where we are is that we have memory loss in this space, right?
Yeah.
But not to define it by like quizzing and trying to push past and say, okay, people, yep, you know, like just as I suspected, like the people with dementia like could not remember these things. And there are unique things about music where sometimes it does elicit memories and it can be really beautiful and the things that come up. But the point of the therapist is not to undo the dementia, at least in my paradigm, right? And there are things also where impairments can be a real part of disabled culture and disabled identity, like that sometimes, you know, even like for me, I have asthma, right? And there are times when I'm like, yeah, this is definitely an impairment. And just to clarify, like, I don't identify as disabled because of that, but I do experience impairment through my asthma where sometimes I'm like, yeah, no, I really just want to.
You're literally lacking breath.
Yeah, like, I just want to be able to breathe. And sometimes, you know, both, we can hold both of those things where sometimes there are things where it's like a person may be like, I'm experiencing an impairment, like, I had a traumatic brain injury and I used to walk and now don't, and I want to build back toward walking. And music therapy can help that.
Yes.
But the risk is that when we have such a distance in power that sometimes those desires and those goals can be assumed because the sort of non-disabled helper figure can look at a disabled person and say, I bet that you, like, you know, I bet you want to be able to walk because I can see that you're not walking, right?
Yeah.
And for, like, forget about the rest of, like, what, a, you know, what it means to be a person.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. That's so good. I think in the social justice conversation, ableism gets lost. We talk a lot about other marginalized identities, but not necessarily.
And it's so, with music therapy in particular, ableism is so much at play.
Yes.
I want to talk about another thing about like how, I guess, or what it means to practice with a social justice paradigm.
Oh, tell me.
So this is sort of a different topic, but
that's okay.
So there's one we've been talking about, like when you're in the therapy space, you know, on a personal level, is your therapist amplifying or minimizing your marginalized identities? I think that for me also what it means to practice with a social justice paradigm is that therapy is not just a space where we sort of bring all of our traumas that we have from existing in a society that's violent toward us, whatever, you know, especially as that operates in terms of our marginalized identities. It's not just a space where we bring in all that trauma and like let it go and have someone validate us like, you're right, that's awful. And then we sort of like go back and just face all of this brutal nature of how, you know, hegemony and hierarchies operate against us. That can be part of therapy, but I think that practicing social justice therapy also means that we as therapists and we as even a profession are working to sort of move this needle of social justice more broadly, where we have to recognize that individual health and communal health are intimately tied. They're co-constitutive, right? They define each other. And so if we're only helping individual people to cope with injustices, that's like not bad, you know, but like there's more to that question of what it means to do social justice in therapy. So the question is even beyond that, or in addition to that, how is this moving the needle of justice more broadly? And maybe that includes also challenging, you know, the ways that a person's privileged identities might show up, and challenging certainly the way our own privileged identities show up and uphold these power structures.
Mm.
So I would hope that in this vision of music therapy and social justice,
yeah,
that our music therapy would celebrate us in our marginalized identities, challenge us in our dominant identities, and move toward an expansive vision of healing that is not only individual but includes our whole communities.
Wow. I love that, V. That's so good. We are going to do an episode in about, I think it's in like a month or so, that is talking about how individual health affects communal health, and we'll explore this idea more. So if this is something that interests you as a listener, I would encourage you to stay tuned and check out that episode. We are coming to the end of our time for today. Do you, V, have any resources, books, websites, etc., that you can think of at the top of your head that you would encourage people to check out? If not, we will always include further resources on our website for each episode.
So there's a book called Experiencing Race as a Music Therapist that has music therapists' personal stories about race impacting their work. There is a whole special issue in the Voices Journal, which is free to access for anyone to access, about queering, which is not just about LGBTQ identities, but is about queering as like destabilizing power things. So there's a whole special issue on that with multiple articles. And there's one that I wrote with several of my friends and colleagues. So
awesome.
That one. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we will put the links to those on the episode notes and on the webpage. If you would like to find out more, the website for The Feeling is Musical is the same as our nonprofit. It is scsamcatmusicproject.org. You can find the podcast page there and then look for any resources that you would want to. If you would like to stay tuned, follow us on social media. We are on all the platforms at SC Music Project. Next time we'll be talking about community music therapy with Cassie Fox. Stay tuned for that, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye.